Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
It came out of Perth this week. Christian Rossiter is a 49-year-old former stockbroker who wants permission to die. He was once a keen bushwalker, cyclist, rock climber. He had a series of spinal injuries that left him as a quadriplegic. He's now in great pain and needs 24-hour care. Now, if he could, Mr. Rossiter says he would simply stop eating and die. But he can't make that decision given the fact that he's fed by his carers through a tube. He's asked the nurses at his Brightwater Care nursing home to stop feeding him, but they're bound by law, as you can imagine, to continue to feed him, to look after him, to care for him. They've now gone to the Supreme Court for advice. Now, if they are granted the permission to withdraw Mr. Rossiter's food supply, it could set a whole new precedent in the euthanasia debate. Dr. Greg Pike is a medical ethicist and director of the Southern Cross Bioethics Institute and joins me now. Dr. Pike, welcome to Open House again.
Thank you, Sheridan.
Yeah, this really is a very, very sad story to be talking about, but an important one for us to be wrestling with. Brightwater Care has gone to the Supreme Court for answers because they see a conflict between two things. One, their duty of care, on the one hand, and number two, their obligation to respect Mr. Rossiter's wishes. I mean, it really is an ethical dilemma, isn't it?
It is a serious dilemma, and as you've outlined right at the start, it's the type of dilemma which really is the leading edge of a far larger debate, and the implications, if this were to be permitted by the Supreme Court, could be quite profound, because I think to really clarify this, we need to think specifically about what's being requested here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's one really important distinction I'd like to make at the start, and hopefully it's something that we will nevertheless puzzle over, but I think ethicists have thought this through for some time and come up with this particular distinction. And that relates to the distinction between medical care and when it can be withdrawn,
mm-hmm.
versus the provision of something natural like food and fluids.
Okay, explore that.
Clearly, in this example, it's a provision of food and fluids by an unusual means, but it's nevertheless food and fluids. It's the type of thing which sustains someone's life. Now, the reason that many laws in our country allow for the refusal of treatment is based on the ethical idea that when treatment is burdensome or futile, disproportionate to any benefit that one can derive from it, then it's quite legitimate for that to be removed.
Mm-hmm. In this case, you know, if the tubes were burdensome, is that what you're saying? That then it would be.
No, I'm drawing a distinction between this and what I've just described. So, mm-hmm. medical treatment like an iron lung, say, or mm-hmm. Someone I know who's receiving dialysis treatment, which has become so painful that he's considered, you know, the possibility of having that removed.
Mm.
That's the removal of treatment, because then the person would die from the underlying condition.
Mm-hmm.
But not having food and fluid is not an underlying condition. It's actually, in this case, would be a pathway to starvation and dehydration, a rather unpleasant, long and slow death.
Mm-hmm.
So, whereas if you remove medical treatment and the person dies from the underlying condition, that's quite different than removing food and fluids and they just starve to death, because food and mm. fluids is something natural that supplies someone's life, that supports them.
Yeah.
And so that will help us see that in this particular case, as tragic as it is and how hard it will certainly be for us to get our minds around what it must feel like to be in that sort of set of circumstances, nevertheless remains a suicidal intent.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Rossiter does want to die.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is that any other person, any able-bodied person, I actually mean that in the full meaning of the phrase, any able-bodied person could actually choose to make that decision, as horrific as that decision would actually be.
That's right.
But because of Mr. Rossiter's quadriplegia, he can't make that decision.
Exactly, and that's where the dilemma lies.
And therein lies the dilemma.
That's right, and you may recall, and some of the listeners may recall, the case of Terry Schiavo over in the States.
Mm.
Now, in one sense, I know it sounds odd, but that's almost an easier case. Because she, by not being legally competent, not being aware, was not able to express her wishes. And so, in a sense, it was easier to just default to the situation of supporting her life by leaving the tube in place. And so, you know, that was the case up until what then ensued, in which case the tube was removed and she died.
Mm-hmm.
But that's almost easier. Here we have someone actually refusing the continuation of the food and fluids, although originally I presume Mr. Rossiter would have agreed to the medical process of having the PEG tube put into his stomach.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, could it be said that he's actually being force-fed because he's actually being fed against his will?
That's a really, really hard one to... I think what we think of when we hear of force feeding is a sort of almost a violent act of stuffing food down someone's throat. This is such a unique set of circumstances that I don't think it's acceptable to really call it force feeding.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the type of circumstance where it creates this terrible dilemma between his wish and the typical duty of care that medical professionals have. And herein lies, I think, part of the bigger issue, and that is that as this represents, by the removal of that food and fluids, an assistance to his suicide, because that's really what it is,
mm-hmm.
Anyone actually acquiescing to that is participating in his suicide,
mm-hmm.
then that's where the precedent lies for assistance of suicides. And then it's no surprise that advocates like Dr. Nitschke are very close by, because this becomes a lead case for the euthanasia debate.
Yes, the decision that happens here will actually have far-reaching ramifications for community in general.
It can have. There was a similar sort of case that really qualified food and fluids, in my opinion erroneously, as medical treatment in Victoria not long ago. And that set somewhat of a precedent. As many of these things go, they're very small increments. You need one case like this here, one like that somewhere else. And in the background, of course, is the whole euthanasia debate, which is premised on the idea of, you know, someone's choice to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so once that becomes the real sharp edge, someone choosing to die, and then the state or other individuals participating in that, then we have something which is really very serious. And as we see from other countries, Netherlands most notably, that once you try and set up a set of circumstances to permit euthanasia or assisted suicide, it's terribly hard, if not impossible, to contain. And in the Netherlands, we've seen a whole series of changes which have eventuated in newborns being euthanized, certainly 12 to 16-year-olds euthanized. And that's, you know, admittedly extremely difficult cases, in many of them. But I think what happens is you try to put a fence around a very, very specific case. And as the saying goes, hard cases make bad law. There are lots of other others who suffer as a consequence of a law being made that may allow that.
Yeah. Dr. Greg Pike is with us on Open House, director of the Southern Cross Bioethics Institute in South Australia. We're talking about this case of Christian Rossiter, quadriplegic man in Perth who's asked his carers to stop feeding him. He actually simply wants to die, and it's an ethical dilemma. I'd like to open up the conversation, 1-300-40-2020. I wonder if you've been in a situation where you look after somebody who's had severe disabilities and they've also wrestled with finding hope again, with keeping on going. How did they do it? 1-300-40-2020. What's your view on this whole euthanasia thing? Because that's what we're talking about here, or assisted suicide, as Dr. Pike's been reminding us about. 1-300-40-2020 for any idea, thought, story you can add to the conversation that can help us move a step along. So, Dr. Pike, if this... It's one thing for us to say, I mean, because in many ways, this is actually an individual decision that will could actually have then community ramifications, as you were just talking about there, if it goes as far as what we've actually seen in Holland, etc. And yet it's one thing for us to say this man should try and hold on for the sake of community and for the sake of what could actually be unleashed on community if he chooses to keep on going down this path, and indeed if the Supreme Court actually give his carers the legal right to do so. Boy, how do you actually help somebody, though, when they are feeling that down to keep on going for the sake of others? That's to some degree what we're actually asking him to do.
It's interesting that you've expressed it as that down, because I think that's a very real aspect of it, it's almost like an existential depth of depression, which in some respects it's understandable to see developing. And I think in that very set of circumstances, That's the type of situation where things like real hope and real depth of dealing with that existential pain, not just physical pain, but existential pain, mm-hmm. is something that that really genuinely can be offered. One thing that's come out of various studies with euthanasia, or at least with euthanasia requests, is that people do change quite significantly their requests. So one day they might beg for euthanasia, and a couple of days later thank those involved for not administering it.
Is that right?
Yeah, there are quite a few studies to indicate that. And I think what that tells you is that, as you might expect, when someone's in a despairing situation, some rather simple things sometimes, or profound things, can make such a difference to their outlook that they will change completely on what they would have otherwise wanted.
Mm.
And really, I think another interesting aspect of this really connects in with the disability issue itself. Again, it's relatively well known and expected, as you'd understand, I suppose, that someone who suffered an injury and become disabled would have a huge adjustment period of a great deal of physical issues and mental issues to deal with, and certainly a lot of rather deep issues about, you know, can I go on living like this, not being able to do what I used to do, having the indignity of what happens to my body. But, you know, I, in some respects, I'm reminded of a relation of mine. She was in a wheelchair for many, many years, and I went to visit her as she was very ill and somewhat near death, and she was gasping for air as she said to me, Greg, look, I've just had the most wonderful life. Now, for someone who's not in that situation, you go, how can that possibly be?
Mm.
And yet that was her perspective. Now, the difficulty we find ourselves in is that there's someone like that, but there's also someone like Christian Rossiter who doesn't feel that. What should our response be as a community to that set of circumstances? And one thing we have to say is that it's possible to be like my cousin.
Yes.
We know at least that that's possible.
Yes.
And that, in her case, was a remarkable affirmation of life in the midst of a very, very trying set of circumstances.
Mm.
And she died shortly afterwards.
Elizabeth has called through. I just want to throw her into the conversation. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Let's bring you into the conversation. What's your understanding? You're a palliative care nurse, I believe?
I am. That's mm-hmm. one of the many forms of nursing I've done in 35 years.
Mm, okay, and where do you come down into these kinds of debates on euthanasia, etc.?
I certainly believe it is a personal choice. I believe that if you were young in a nursing home, debilitated with no future in front of you, it should be allowed to be your choice, like the Victorian young man. Yes, I've seen a lot of people who make decisions about ending their lives, and because we don't intervene in that in 99% of cases, then those decisions quite often are reversible and they're happy that they didn't make that final decision.
Mm.
But when you come to the point where you really know what you want and you're not being kept alive for yourself but for other people, then sometimes there comes a time in your life where you should be allowed to make that choice.
What do you think about the ethical line, though, that, of course, the decision that you personally make actually has ramifications down the road, down the track, for the broader community?
I think everyone can have a say in what happens, but ultimately it should be your choice right at the very end. And I think there are lots of ways to look at that choice and to make that decision. But as I say, every case has to be judged on its own merits, but you should not be told, no, you're simply not allowed to do this. And you come to those choices at different stages in your life. I was a firm non-believer in abortion. But as I've aged and seen different things happen in life, then those choices have changed in my mind. And you can't tell someone ultimately what to do themselves. But I think they need to be terminal. I don't think it needs to be just severe depression, because that's a dreadful illness in itself. But to be terminally disabled is a different story altogether.
Okay, Elizabeth, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking part in the show. Open house right across the nation, 1300 40 20 20. If you've got a thought about the euthanasia issue, and in particular, when the decision has to come down to an individual decision, maybe you're in that situation, hypothetically, where you just feel you want to end your life, and yet it has ramifications for the community. If you actually do that, it'll open up a floodwater of other possible people wanting to follow in your lead. What do you do? It is an ethical dilemma, it really is. 1-300-40-2020. Dr. Greg Pike, any comments on what Elizabeth was talking about there?
Sheridan, just a couple of things. It's interesting that abortion was mentioned because in some respects that can tell us something. In the 70s, or 60s really, when a lot of the abortion debate was occurring, it was always rape and incest as the or extreme disability as the cases for which abortion would be permitted, and that's the grounds upon which the law was originally changed. Now, just in my state, the one I'm familiar with, we have nearly 5,000 abortions a year, 98% are healthy mothers, healthy babies.
Mm.
Now, that tells you something about how hard to contain these sorts of difficult moral issues are once they get into the legislative arena.
Yes.
And the other issue I think very strongly connected is the matter of choice, which I think was Elizabeth.
Yes.
Elizabeth was saying was the key. The difficulty there is that choice is a very odd phenomenon, people having just their choice makes it sound like that is all that counts. But in reality, the business of individual choice doesn't actually exist as a simple phenomenon that someone can just choose something without any coercion, without any pressure, without any other issues going on, without any other possibilities to see, which they may not have seen, a whole range of things like that, plus the fact that each individual is very much a connected part of a community.
Mm.
And being, I think in some respects in modern Western societies, we've certainly lost a lot of that with our deep sense of individualism and choice being paramount above everything else. Mm. Certainly choice drove the abortion debate.
Greg Pike, what are the qualities that you have seen in people that have been in severe pain, might be paraplegia, quadriplegia, whatever it might be, but have been, like the relative you were telling us about before, that have been able to find hope, get through? Are there a certain kind of collection of qualities or values or beliefs or something that actually helped them get through?
Really, I can only talk anecdotally. I don't sort of have a wide experience with people with particular disabilities, just a few anecdotal cases. And mm. I think certainly some of the keys to me seem to be that there was a few particular key loves in life. For one, it was music. This lady could sing, and she sang pretty much to her deathbed. For my cousin, it was very much her family. As a Christian myself, I think that those deepest existential questions are answered by our faith, and that's where the deepest of hopes come from.
Mm.
And yet it's very difficult in the sense that we are saying that in a society where not all share that, as much as we might wish they would. But the difficulty then comes that our influence in things like laws has implications for people who don't share that hope.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's a particularly difficult thing. But just a very quick comment about Mr. Rossiter. Now, not knowing the details of his case, of course, all we have are the newspaper reports. But I believe that it was 2004 that he was injured on the bicycle, and was in the condition of quadriplegia. Now that means for some 5 years he's been receiving food and fluids.
Mm.
And I just wonder what's really gone on that has caused this change now. It may be there's a particular physical thing or pain or something else that's caused that. But it might also be that there's particular influences and things available and suggestions to him that might have driven this. And so what people say and what is available has huge power. And if I could then extrapolate that out to the possibility that our society may have euthanasia available, that changes people's choices.
Mm.
That if you're in a situation, as your previous caller, I think, was saying, of really difficult times, and you know that that's an option the state says is okay, so, you know, there's a sense in which it informs your value system, when that's available for you, then your choices are influenced. And I think, you know, back to the abortion thing, if there was not legal abortion available, there wouldn't be nearly as many abortions because women would make choices of a different nature.
Mm.
So what's available legally does change how people behave.
Greg, you clarified before, there's a slight nuance that we have to really get here when it comes to the use of technology and when it is ethically okay to take that technology away because it's actually sustaining life where otherwise it wouldn't. Just clarify that again.
I have to preface it by saying that this is a difficult distinction that is really the point of the whole of a lot of the debate, and that is that whilst the tube down the throat, or I think more correctly in Mr. Rossiter's case, the peg, which is a small tube directly through his abdomen into the stomach, whilst that is an artificial thing, to draw a simple distinction between artificial things and a spoon to the mouth for someone who can hardly swallow them might take hours to feed them. To call something artificial when the food itself is the thing which simply sustains somebody.
Mm. It's not a machine that's sustaining him, it's actually food that's sustaining him.
It's food that's sustaining
him. This is just the delivery mechanism.
It's just the delivery means. It's just like a I know it sounds crude, but it's like an extended spoon.
Mm.
We have to focus on what is really the relevant ethical point, and that is, what is the end goal? The end goal is to sustain the body, and with a simple means, which is food, which everyone gets sustained by. Delivery means might be slightly different. But that's different than, say, an artificial lung, where someone is actually sustained in breathing by an artificial machine. When that's removed, the breathing will stop because there's an underlying condition, an underlying disease from which they will die.
Mm.
So to die from a disease is one thing, but to die from starvation and dehydration is quite another.
Could Joanne have a point, though, in the sense that 100 years ago, maybe even the technology for these tubes to actually be administered to Christian Rossiter in Perth, a man who does want to take his life because of his pain, wouldn't have even been available anyway?
Well, that's very true, and I suppose really what that's giving voice to is the fact that we have modern medical dilemmas. They are no less ethically important for us to try and find out what is right for human beings to do, because now they're here, we have to address them, and we have to find out what is the right thing to do. The fact that they didn't exist many, many years ago doesn't really help us, because that's a different set of circumstances, and the ethical, the critical ethical principles remain the same, like the value of human life, the good of health, and all those sorts of things. And the things that are good for human beings to experience, they all remain the same. But the ethical discussions we have are modified by what's available. And so medically now we have things available which make it terribly hard for us to sift through how to reapply those most basic principles to the new set of circumstances. So I don't know that that actually helps us all that much, because, well, that was back then. And yes, we might have done something different back then, because there was no peg or tube available, and we would have made an ethical distinction, hopefully on the right basic principles. And now we're trying to apply those same correct ethical principles to a new set of circumstances with new things available. You see, we find very, very difficult circumstances also with newborn children, premature children, and they would normally just die. Prior to medical treatment. We now have this medical means available to keep 22-week-old fetuses alive. And there's all these dilemmas about when we should use that technology and when we should not, and whether it's resource-rich and whether we're using resources we shouldn't use, and so on.
Mm.
So modern medical means do make these discussions more difficult, but I think the same basic principles apply, as many of your listeners have been bringing forward. Look, I certainly don't want to downplay the extreme difficulty of Mr. Rossiter's circumstances and how Christian families, as the most recent caller mentioned, may decide to have a feeding tube removed. Whilst I might not agree with that, I can understand the enormous complexity of feelings, emotions, and difficulties in that.
Yeah. Greg, I really appreciate your time tonight, especially hanging on for a while and responding to callers. Thanks for your time.
No, thanks.
Dr. Greg Pike there from the Southern Cross Bioethics Institute.
We hope you enjoy this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.